BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Five Lives Rugby Union Daily with Chris Jones.
Right, Rugby Union Daily, we're pitch side at the Aviva after Ireland have gone back to back. They beat Scotland 17-13, running amongst it with the Irish players. Jack Crowley, how about that, Jack? Back to back Six Nations champions.
Yeah, it's special. It didn't come easy. Didn't expect it to come easy because of the magnitude the competition is and how competitive it is. And credit to Scotland. They were really stuck in it and right till the end, you saw. So special to get the win in the end.
Can you take us into the changing room at half time and what was said by Andy Farrell or Peter Omani? Because your intensity after half time was pretty extraordinary.
We knew we were in a test match. You know, it's something that this group is really good at is never panicking, no matter what situation we're in, whether we're ahead or we're behind. And we managed half time really well, spoke about our action points and came out and delivered. But again, Scotland were unbelievably difficult to break down, and credit to them.
A quick word about your captain. Chat around, it might be his last game. How much did he put out there?
I don't know. Look, as a group, we spoke about delivering on the pitch tonight, getting a trophy for the people that we're playing at home for, and that's as far as we talk about. But yeah, special for the lads not involved tonight as well.
Enjoy the celebration.
Very much. Cheers. Thank you.
Right, from Jack Crowley to Robbie Henshaw. Robbie, you've won a few of these now. Still feel as good as they always do?
Yeah, unbelievable. Winning it at home is just so special. And, you know, we knew it was going to be a tough game. Big battle against Scotland. They always show up against us. And, you know, it's just so special to do it for the lads in the group, for the management and everyone who's you know, worked unbelievably hard over the last 3 months.
Yeah, the what was the message at half-time? I asked this question to Jack just now, because after half-time, you really came out of it with real intensity.
Yeah, we knew we had to up the ante a bit. We were working incredibly hard in the first half, but Scotland just had a wall in front of us, and they defended really well, held us up in the tackle, slowed us down. But the coach just said we need to stay at it, keep attacking, and eventually we started finding some breaks and some metres through the contact. So that was it.
And just finally, where does this team go from here? I know short term it's off into Dublin with a load of Guinness, but longer term, South Africa in the summer, a chance to really cement your legacy, I suppose.
Yeah, listen, it's great to bounce back from how the World Cup went for this team. It was so important that we finished on a high, and we won this week and won some silverware. We go back to our clubs for a few months now, and then we regroup in the summer for two tests against the world champions. And I suppose that's it's a great opportunity for players to step up and to have another go.
Have a great few days celebrating. Thanks, Robbie.
Cheers.
Right, Robbie Henshaw, and before him, Jack Crowley on this Rugby Union Daily as Ireland go back-to-back. They win the Six Nations title. The rain is starting to fall at the Aviva, but the celebrations will go long into the St Patrick's weekend. Ireland 17, Scotland 13, a final score. Right, from pitch side, I'm going to go back up to our commentary position where Fraser Brown and no doubt a delighted Tommy Bowe are waiting.
Five Lives Rugby Union Daily with Chris Jones.
Right, I've rushed up from pit side back to our commentary position. The Ireland players hugging their families. A lot of them got their kids on the pitch. And the stands gradually starting to thin out as this Aviva Stadium crowd dances into the Dublin Patrick's Day night. Ireland 17, Scotland 13. On the way, all the reaction from Lyon and France against England. We'll also talk about Wales and Italy after Italy's famous win in Cardiff. But where do Wales go from here? But Tommy Bowe and Fraser Brown, while I was down pitch side, I hear you're a selfie machine, Tommy. Everyone wants a little bit of you.
Oh, thanks very much, Chris. I mean, it's St. Patrick's weekend. Ireland have just won the Six Nations, and I'm waiting to go out and party. But we have to wait while you go and interview every person on the sideline there. But I'm delighted you've come back to join us. And
the temerity of me doing my job, God forbid.
I mean, we're nearly three quarters of the way through the England-France match at this stage.
We had this exactly last year, where we kept Jamie Heaslett waiting. And, you know, former Ireland players on Six Nations night, you're itching to get out there into the night, aren't you?
Oh, listen, Dublin can wait for me, I suppose. Dublin can wait for Chris Jones. We're going to show him it all tonight. But listen, yeah, lots of celebrating. A wonderful evening for Ireland, for Irish rugby. All the Irish supporters have now left. They're out in the middle of Temple Bar at the moment, partying hard. And the Irish team, no doubt, will be joining them very shortly.
Fraser, your verdict?
The best team won. Best team won the Six Nations. I think I think Ireland started fast in the first two games, obviously, like an excellent performance away in France. And I think maybe limp to the finish line is a little bit harsh, but certainly sort of tailored off as they went. And from a Scotland point of view, thank goodness Scotland showed up today. Because like there was a fear off the back of last weekend in Rome that what could happen here today with an Irish team going for another championship and a Scotland team who could have been licking their wounds. But they didn't. They showed up today. They put in a defensive performance, certainly.
Yeah, listen, what you're saying, that they limped to the finish line. England last weekend obviously beating Ireland, scuppering their chances of back-to-back Grand Slams, and against Scotland really fighting Ireland all the way to the final whistle there. I don't know whether I don't think Ireland were maybe at the level that they were earlier on in the competition, but I also think the competition and the opposition up against Ireland really rose to the occasion. And I think England last weekend was the best English performance we've seen in years, I would say, arguably. And against Scotland today, there's a lot of question marks. This is now 10 losses in a row against Ireland, but I think this is one of probably their best performances against Ireland in those 10 matches.
Yeah, I mean, limped was strong.
I agree with what you're saying.
I definitely want to pick up on that. But to Tommy's point, yeah, there were times when we kept saying in commentary, Fraser, the dam's going to burst, the dam's going to burst, the dam's going to burst. And look, that try from Andrew Porter was decisive. But time and time again, Scotland kind of defied logic and kept Ireland out. But a bit too much power, a bit too much depth in the end.
Yeah, look, I mean, that defensive performance reminded me of sort of 4 years ago when Steve Tandy first came in. Scotland went from playing the fastest rugby in the world, or so it was called, in Japan in 2019, and the needle completely swung the other way, and it became about staying in games, being hard to break down, hard to beat. And the first game of Steve Tandy's sort of reign as defence coach was here against Ireland in Dublin, Ireland won that game, but that was the start of this sort of like Scotland defensive machine that grew over the next couple of years. We probably haven't seen a defensive performance like that from Scotland for a number of years. They're a good defensive side, but today it was just all grit, you know, like those two or three try-saving tackles, one around in the first half, that line-out play around the front, and then certainly the knock-on, or Xander Ferguson knocking it out of Tadhg Furlong's hands, and then the Andy Christie cover tackle just to stop Ireland kind of walking it in.
And the Cameron Redpath one.
So like that type of grit, probably desperation, and it was desperate. You know, any one of those had gone in, the dam was going to burst. And I think credit to Scotland, because they had that desperation and they had that physicality. You know, there was a worry about Ireland's bench and the power they bring off the bench. You know, could Scotland match that? And again, you know, that second half was just wave after wave after wave of green attack breaking on the Scottish line. So, yeah, there was a desperation about Scotland today, and they didn't do enough to win, and that's probably more down to their own failings from an attacking point of view and not holding on to the ball and respecting enough. But defensively, that was as good as I've seen them in a long time.
And at times, they just couldn't get out their half and their 22, could they? And even that time when Ireland did make an error, they then kept playing Scotland, made an error themselves, and Ringrose got away. So, Tommy, not to dampen at all the celebrations, you know, it's going to be another brilliant night. It's another famous night for Irish rugby, and it's a fantastic achievement. Very few teams go back-to-back. It needs to be celebrated and marked. But do you think that Ireland at the start of the championship, or this time last year, would have put the game to bed sooner, or is that just testament to Scotland's fantastic defence?
It seems a long time ago since that match in Marseille, where we were both over there, got to witness La Marseillaise, the French national anthem, in that home city. It was one of the most memorable occasions of my life. And then Ireland coming out of the blocks and putting that French team to the sword. I thought, oh my goodness, there's no such thing as a hangover after this World Cup. Ireland carried that on for the first two matches of the competition, and we were wondering, what are we seeing here? And we probably got a little bit ahead of ourselves as Irish supporters, because those three matches, I don't think Ireland really got pushed. They got an early lead, and they were able to just throw the ball about and play some really enterprising, exciting rugby, and it came off, and it looked wonderful. England last weekend were able to, they did their homework, they put Ireland's set pieces under an awful lot of pressure. They put clear in their lines, getting out of their own half under pressure. And there were a few question marks after that game, and people wondering how would they react going into this Scotland game. And I think Scotland did their homework too. So from an Ireland point of view, I think they've 80 points. The points difference is 80 points or 90 points, which is just...
84, yeah.
Which is remarkable. But at the same time, I don't think Andy Farrell is going to get too carried away. I don't think maybe this Irish team are quite as head of the pack that maybe a lot of supporters and the Irish public probably think. And obviously the summer tour against South Africa is going to be a huge challenge. Three matches over there to Scotland. I'm sure South Africa are going to try and, you know, they have a bone to pick with this Irish team, and certainly the pundits going into that one. But Ireland would be delighted. They played some brilliant rugby. They've won four games out of five. They played, they've won, is it, three of them with bonus points. The last two have been a lot tighter. And I think just Scotland and England have really fronted up to the physical battle. And whenever you are one of the top teams in the world, the opposition have to pull out their big performances. And that's what happened the last 2 weeks.
A couple more on Ireland before we do the verdict on Scotland, then discuss Wales, Italy, and then we go to Leon. And of course, loads more on our Sunday night for Monday morning pod with John, Ugo and Sam. We'll be looking at the Six Nations as a whole. So plenty more to come on the Rugby Union Daily. But a word to both of you about Peter Omani. Some reports came out in the Irish press that this could be his last ever game. We know there was something of confusion over his contract situation, whether he's going to get a central contract staying at Munster, X, Y and Z. And the emotion, Tommy, from him before, during and after the game very much looked like a man for whom this may have been the end of a quite incredible international career.
Yeah, the emotion at the anthem was incredible, something I haven't really seen from him in the past couple of matches. And then on the final whistle, the camera went to him as well. He was head in his hands. One of the other members of the management was there giving him a hug. It looked very sentimental. It looked like this match meant an awful lot to him. Of course it meant a lot to him. He was the Irish captain. They've just won the Six Nations, but it seemed there was something a little bit more. I also watched him walking around the pitch. Andy Farrell gave him a really special embrace. And reading Peter's lips, he said, "Oh, I know, I got a little bit emotional before the match." And then himself and Conor Murray both handing the trophy and trying to hide the fact that they've all five fingers up, because the two of them now, I think I'm right in saying, have won five Six Nations each. Ooh. Which is pretty...
So, yeah, so 14, 15, 18, 23, 24.
Yeah, pretty damn good. And I just read...
Fair play, five titles. I think five generations, a large family.
I think
breeding.
He just said on the headline I just saw in something popping up on my phone that if this was my last game, what a way to go out. But he said that he does have to speak to his family before he makes any decision. But Peter O'Mahony, an incredible servant to the Irish team. Five Six Nations to captain them to potentially his last ever game. My goodness, what a way to go out.
Yeah, just to echo that, you know, I thought the anthems was pretty telling. Like, Peter O'Mahony's a pretty stoic character. He doesn't show that much emotion in around before or after games in the anthem. Plenty of emotion on the pitch, but, no, I thought
And you've had some battles, both for club and country.
Well, that's it. I'd love to ask you, because Glasgow Munster is such a well-known battle, and Pete has always been at the forefront of it, yourself.
I'm still unsure where the Glasgow Munster kind of animosity comes from, but it's there. Look, I think one of the biggest compliments you could probably pay Pete from an opposition point of view is you hate to see his name on a team sheet. You do. There's so much talent in the Munster squad, so much talent in the Irish squad in and around that back row. You know, you've got Ryan Baird sitting on the bench, and still you hate to see Peter O'Mahony's name on the starting team sheet.
And, a warrior.
Yeah. You know, from my point of view, from a line-out point of view, I hate him in there. He is so fast off the floor. You can't throw anywhere near him. It cuts your options down. And for Ireland, for so long, that was an absolute nightmare from a Scottish point of view, from a Glasgow point of view when playing Munster. He is just a pest and a menace in around there. So seeing his name on a team sheet, it's a battle in itself, because you know that you're going to have an absolute war on your hands every single time you go into a ruck, every set piece you go to. So, what a servant he's been for both.
And if he is to exit the international stage and he joins Keith Earls and Johnny Sexton and, I mean, Kian Healy, another absolute stalwart with all those titles himself, another one for him. I mean, how he still is. We'd say this about Dan Cole with England, Tommy. How he is still trucking. I mean, goodness me. Every team evolves. Every team has a turnover of players. There are others in this Ireland side who are in their 30s. You know, Bundiaki at 33, Gibson Park at 32, Ty Burn at 32, still with rugby ahead of them. I suppose my question to you, Tommy, is Ireland have to make sure this group hasn't peaked. You know, whether it was Six Nations last year or at points during that World Cup wasn't the high point, because they've won the title, and that's a brilliant achievement, but it's very hard to sustain and get better and better, especially with the box lying in wait come the summer.
Absolutely. And there were these question marks, of course, when Johnny Sexton stepped away. Jack Crowley has stepped into those boots and done an incredible job. I still don't think in the last two games, when the pressure's come on, he's been quite as accomplished and looked quite as comfortable. But myself and Fraser were talking about this after the match as well, and one of the names that you mentioned that is getting on a little bit in age is Jemison Gibson-Park. Because Conor Murray is a guy who might have another year or two left in his career. We still haven't quite found who's going to be stepping into that bench slot. And potentially, if Gibson-Park was to get injured, who is going to be that starting nine? And I think whatever about Jack Crowley being a 10, he's a guy, he looks very comfortable there. But is Craig Casey the next number nine for Ireland going forward? I think there's a lot of question marks out there. And even behind Craig Casey, who's coming up the ranks as well. So, yes, with this Irish team, it is about evolving. It's about another cycle of years until the next World Cup. And they'll be delighted with this Six Nations. But it is about trying to find the new breed, the next guys coming through to continue this cycle. Because if you don't do that and you don't have that strength and depth and that competition for places, that's where you lose, you get a bit complacent, and that's when you don't reach your top, your limit.
And if they weren't quite able to settle the argument of who is the greatest Six Nations side, which I think they would have done if they'd gone back-to-back with slams, because it's not been done in the Six Nations era. Of course, they're in the conversation, and a series win in South Africa would really cement their standing on the global stage. Scotland, Fraser, I mean, after all that, it's a 2 out of 5 campaign. And plenty of what-ifs, not least the fact that Andrew Porter's try, we haven't seen compelling evidence it was down. And, you know, the officials seemed happy, but it's just one of those campaigns again for Scotland. You know, so many good bits here and there, but again, short of winning anything and short of being serious contenders for the title.
Just what-ifs again, I think, from Scotland. And all of it within their own control. You know, they've not been... I mean, even at points today, they weren't massively outplayed off the park by any of the teams. You know, they had opportunity, more than enough opportunities against France to go and win that game before the final TMO decision. In Italy last week, they just never showed up. They never came out the changing room after half time. You know, all within their control. And then even today, even with that Irish onslaught in the second half, they had enough opportunities to get out of their half and then to try and grab hold of the momentum in that game again and try and wrestle themselves into field position. The only genuine Scottish attack, where they held on to the ball in around the Irish 22 in the second half, Hugh Jones slips through 3 tackles and scores. And that's just the story for Scotland. So although it was heroic defensively, it's missed opportunities in attack. It's a lack of, I don't know, lack of composure from an attacking point of view.
Listen, I am a massive fan of Finn Russell. I think he's a maverick. He's exciting. He gets the crowd on their feet. Is he what Scotland need at the minute? You think of Ben Healy, who's come over from Munster to Scotland. He hasn't got many opportunities. It doesn't look like he's going to get many opportunities, but he's a player who will put the ball in behind the opposition. He's not going to maybe pull a rabbit out of a hat like Finn does, but Finn has had so many chances in so many Six Nations to pull rabbits out of hat, and it hasn't quite worked. And we shouldn't all be putting Scotland's results and everything else on the 10. That is a key playmaker in every team. And you think of the Dan Biggers with Wales, you think of the Owen Farrells with England, you think of the Johnny Sexton with Ireland. These guys aren't mavericks. They're not guys who play on the line like Finn Russell does, but they win championships. And if Scotland...
I don't know, Tom. I mean, I don't know. What do you think, Fraser?
I think there's the question to be asked about when you play Test rugby, do you want to play to enjoy it or do you want to play to win? And I think when you watch Scotland, you see a team that really enjoy how they play. But then you have to ask the question, do you see them winning titles with that particular brand of rugby? That very 50-50 risky style at times in games. And I think we saw tonight, with a little bit more control, Scotland could have built themselves
big
into
time.
The game.
Remember, like, Ireland scored, was it the 3 points or whatever? Finn Russell sprinted up to the halfway line. This is where you need to be composed. They were so composed in that first half. Tried to take the quick kick off, kicked it out on the full. All of a sudden, it just gives Ireland back that opportunity. It's so small margins when it comes to international rugby. And look, we know Finn Russell is incredible and he's box office and he can score and set up some wonderful tries. But exactly, is it about playing attractive rugby or is it about playing winning rugby?
I think the issue for me is there needs to be more, and you know, I was in this team a year ago, there needs to be more players in that team who can also step up.
Yeah.
You know, and again, like we were talking off air, Hugh Jones scored that try. That was just about the only time we saw Hugh in the game. You know, Duane van der Merwe, he didn't get much space, and Ireland did a brilliant job just shutting down his space, but we didn't really see him in the game. Stafford McDowell, who played well, had a couple of opportunities in the first half, made a break, but we didn't see them in the game. You know, from a forwards point of view, whenever Scotland got turnover, a transition ball, and they got in around the Scotland the Ireland half, they turned it over, they lost their shape. So while a lot of attention always goes on Finn, it will always go on Finn because of the player that he is, there's more players that need to step up in and around him so that those magic, maverick moments aren't the be-all and end-all. They aren't the things that decide the games more often than not. They're the things that kind of add the cherry on top.
It's those small nuts and bolts. They're the small things that is the difference in Scotland being in the top half of the competition and the bottom half of the competition, because it's those small errors that ultimately cost them so many times.
Well, I mean, Scotland could finish fourth in the championship, and it'll be because they didn't score enough points. You know, bonus point left down in Cardiff, didn't obviously win against France, bonus point left against England, you know, points difference could play a part. They've not scored enough points in attack, so forget about the other bits and pieces of the game. Scotland, for such a great attacking side, and they are devastating off counter-attack. You know, I think Scotland are probably the best side in the world, test side in the world, off counter-attack, off kick counter, with the players at their disposal. But their shape attack is not creating enough points for them to go and win games.
Well, Chris?
I think it's such an interesting debate, and I'll bow to both their expertise. I suppose the question is, if you take Finn out and put in a more pragmatic 10, do Scotland have enough around that pragmatic 10 in terms of, you know, their scrum has been marched back? And I know their scrum has improved in terms of their mauling, in terms of the error count, for then a pragmatic 10 to be able to play them in the right positions. It's almost like they need Finn to do things like he did at Murrayfield against England to win them test matches, because would a pragmatic 10, I don't know, would a Dan Biggeray's pomp take Scotland in a new direction, or do they need other parts of the game in order for that 10 to do that?
Well, if I look at that back line, they don't need a Finn Russell to unleash them, but with an amazing pass, because that back line is full of talent. They just need the ball to be, they just need options and to get the ball to put them in space, and the pack need to be put on the front foot and put into the right areas of the pitch. Listen, I'm not saying Ben Healy is the answer, but he's not even on the bench. He doesn't even get any game time. So maybe I'm wrong. I'm just saying that Finn Russell is a wonderful, wonderful player, but maybe they just put a little bit too much reliance on him, and actually sometimes maybe having somebody who plays the percentages might be the difference to this Scottish team, because this is a Scotland team. We might not see a Scotland team with so much talent in it for another couple of years. So they don't want to waste these opportunities, and there has to be questions asked.
So I agree in part. Like, I agree, like, the talent in that back line is enormous. But I also think Finn is the 10 for me. Finn is Scotland's 10. He is the talisman. He is the main man there. He is the best option
they
have.
Well, no, you see, he shouldn't be, because as a 10, he has to unleash. Your job as a 10 is to make those around you look good.
But I don't think the other players, for how good they are, if you take that back line today, I think Hugh Jones can be incredible.
If he gets the ball.
But he doesn't get himself into the game enough. Duane van der Merwe doesn't get himself into the game.
And who's meant to get him into the game?
Well, themselves. Like, I know you're trying to probe me to say the 10, but like, themselves. Like, they are, you know, they are meant to get themselves
into the
game.
You just want a bit more leadership then, outside, in other parts of the back line.
Yeah, I mean, like, Sione Tuipulotu is obviously not playing today. He got injured.
He is
a huge loss. And, like, Stafford has been excellent. Stafford McDowell has been excellent all year for Glasgow. This is his first ever Six Nation game. So to put him in and expect that amount of leadership, and I thought Stafford played well tonight, but to put him in and expect him to have that kind of same command outside Finn, it's not going to happen in his first game in. So obviously losing Sione is a big loss, and a lot of the time when there's pressure on Finn, Scotland use Sione as that sort of first receiver. It goes 9 to 12, usually with 13 short, 10 out the back, and they use that as their way of getting gain line, getting over the gain line. Without that outlet, a lot of it does go on to Finn.
Could you put Sione at 13, Finn at 12 and bring in a more pragmatic 10?
I'm not an attack coach.
it's a really, really interesting debate. I think it's a great debate because so many of these Scotland players you look at and go, oh, they're really good players. And there were times today where you marvelled at Scotland defensively, and there's been times in Six Nations where you've marvelled at them offensively. And it's just how this crop can't quite bring it together. And not a million miles off, but as it stands, they're two wins out of five, albeit all of them kind of have ifs, what's buts and maybes and extenuating circumstances. But we've gone off on a bit of a tangent. It's Ireland's night, but just a fascinating championship, throwing up so many questions for so many teams, not least Wales. And I was going to say for Italy, I mean, the questions Italy have, they've answered. We'll do loads more on the state of play, on Wales with Sam Warburton on the pod tomorrow. But some news that came in, Warren Gatland said afterwards, he offered his resignation to the chief executive of the WRU, who turned it down and said that's the last thing the union and Welsh rugby wants. Wales 0-5. What do you make of all that, both of you? Not just Wales's performance, their championship, Gatland, whether he was, you know, completely serious about offering to resign, but, you know, clearly he's still got the backing of the WRU, but a lot going on there.
An awful lot going on there. Listen, it's been an extremely difficult and disappointing campaign for Warren Gatland and for Wales. They've been in a fairly turbulent 12 months, both on and off the pitch. But Gatland was kind of parachuted in for the end of the Six Nations last year. He came in, and Wales did really well in the World Cup for the squad and the thought of where they could go. Obviously, this Six Nations, he's trying to bring through some more young players. I think maybe it's just a little snapshot of where the Welsh regions are at the minute, where the Welsh rugby is at the minute. And Warren Gatland is obviously, you know, coming in with such great success in years gone by. Maybe his voice isn't getting the same impact as it did in years gone by. Or maybe he just doesn't have the same players at his disposal that he did have a number of years ago. My question is, though, if Warren Gatland, if the WRU were to accept it, who the hell would they bring in? Because at the minute, I don't think there's any real coach standing out at the minute that would step into the Welsh head coach role and be willing to.
From the Welsh domestic game.
Of course.
Yeah.
But even World Rugby at the minute, there's no real coaches on the market at the moment. And it would be a fairly rash decision for the WU to accept that and then have to go on a hunt for a coach. You'd need to, it would be more a case of, let's put that down the line a little bit. Let's us do our homework and see where we are.
I mean, look, the obvious issue with the Welsh team is that it's not just the national team. You know, that the background of Welsh rugby is chaotic at the minute. So having someone like Warren Gatland in there, he is kind of a steadying ship type of a figure. The criticism, I think, for Gatland in this Six Nations is it's not just about the players at its disposal. It's about, sometimes it's been about the players that have been picked. So, you know, you play France, you drop your most experienced centre partnership. Some of the front rowers have been getting picked to go on the bench. Very, very green. Not in terms of international. Very green in terms of just professional experience. When there are other options available. Now, you can debate whether they're better options or not, but there are other options available to come into a Welsh team that haven't won a game. Last week against France, again, the substitutions, the timing of substitutions, which is obviously a coach's call. You know, Wales are in that game by 2 points. Then you change the halfbacks and then France score, I think it was 20 or 24 unanswered points in the next sort of 16, 18 minutes. So I think that's more the criticism of Warren Gatland in this Six Nations rather than sort of the wider outlook of Welsh rugby, because he's clearly there to do a job for Wales. But those decisions are the ones that are coming under a little bit of scrutiny.
Right, so much to talk about. Glad we've got more pods to come. Tommy, I also love the fact that you're desperate to get out there, but then you open up this huge can of worms about Finn Russell's place in the Scotland team and what role he should play and if he should be at 12 and should he be more pragmatic.
Please,
and should he be unleashing this back line?
Please, Mr. BBC social media man, don't make me a headline tomorrow. Oh. I love you, Finn, really.
Good stuff. Right, thanks so much to Tommy Bowe. Thanks so much to Fraser Brown. It's Ireland's night here at the Aviva. It was Italy's day down in Cardiff. What a win, what a championship for the Azzurri. But the final game of the 2024 Six Nations Championship was in Lyon, France against England, where we find Sarah, Matt and Ashi. That is the other side of this.
On the Football Daily Podcast.
The Women's Football Weekly.
With me, Ellen White.
Ellen White coming forward for England. There is the second.
And me, Ben Haynes, with some of the biggest names in the WSL joining us every week to discuss everything that's happening in the women's game.
Right after the World Cup, got told, we're going to America. I thought, amazing. 10 days into training, did my meniscus, and the next day they flew to America.
Blocked header 6 yards out, Ellen White!
The Women's Football Weekly Podcast.
New episodes every Wednesday.
Subscribe to the Football Daily on BBC Sounds.
5 Lives Rugby Union Daily.
Well, thank you to everyone in Dublin. And of course, we are now in Lyon, where we had an absolute 7-try thriller. But it was France's day in the end. Came down to the last minute, though, didn't it? Of course, I'm Sarah Orchard alongside me. I've got Matt Dawson. I've got Chris Ashton. No pressure, guys. We're going to be thrown out of Lyon in about 15 minutes' time. And we've got the whole Six Nations to wrap up. So are you ready for this, Matt Dawson?
Go.
Ashy?
It's not like the French to really come and just push us out, is it?
I think that's what they're genuinely going to do. Right then, so full time here in Lyon. France 33, England 31. England got more tries than France. But it was a real tale of two halves, Matt Dawson. I mean, we were looking at England in that first half. Memories of the World Cup and some of the less exciting rugby we were watching from England. But second half, brilliant.
Yeah, I could sort of understand why England decided to play that way. They're playing away from home with a enormous French pack, trying to control it, trying to play a little bit more territory and possession and get the bounce of the ball. But that's got to have balance. And when there are opportunities... when England did get turnover ball or they got a bit of quick ball, they then automatically went back to the kicking game rather than using that momentum to try and break the line. Whereas, conversely, that's exactly what France did. They were playing the kicking game, but then turnover ball, my goodness me, led by Damien Penaud, they were lethal in that first half when they wanted to be. But yeah, you're right, second half, England... whether it was hairdryers, boots, or maybe an arm around them, I don't know. But England came out like a completely different side and took it. I mean, genuinely took it to France.
Do you think first half that there was a bit of getting to understand being here, being in this atmosphere, being a shock to the system? Because it's hard to handle, and especially how big the French are and how physical they are. And then you throw on top of that the intimidation of this stadium. A lot of lads haven't played here before, been in this kind of atmosphere. It was intense. I think it shocked them a little bit. Took them a bit of time to get used to it. And they managed to find a way through it, which is pleasing to see. If they hadn't got that try just before half-time, might have been different, but they stuck
that's
in
good,
there.
I think that's a good point, though, Chris, you mentioned there. That try from Morley Lawrence right on the half-time whistle. I mean, England had managed to sort of stem the flow of attack and attack and attack from France, but they were 16-3 down, and you're staring down the barrel. The crowd were going bananas or bonkers for their team, and then all of a sudden it was like someone just pierced the French balloon. Ori Lawrence scores a try, 16-10. Oh, how on earth are England 6 points in this game? And so that's a fair point. That is a fair point.
We've mentioned it quite a few times. Of course, the last time England played France was at Twickenham, which was that 53-10 performance. They really did come out and put on a show. And they showed they could really attack, which has been a real narrative for England throughout this Six Nations. I mean, a lot of column inches have been dedicated to the England defence and the blitz. But ultimately, the attack is what gets fans off their feet, which again is something Jamie George, the captain, has been talking about. And in particular, Chris Ashton, I'm looking at you now. The Tommy Freeman try that came off the line out, couple of hits through the middle and they found the space to finally get it down. That's surely what England can produce when they actually get their attack right.
Yes, very encouraging to see. It just took a little bit of time to get there, which we don't mind as long as it does in the game at some point. But they came out after half time and it seemed like they had a clear set piece and plan strategy to go straight into the line out. It was Slade's pass that put Freeman up the touchline here. Just the speed of pass from Slade is just something we hadn't seen first half at all. And Slade didn't even think about it. As soon as he got it, he fired the pass out to Freeman.
which just started everybody rolling. And Ben Earl was outstanding second half again. He's been England's best player this tournament. He's involved in every good bit of attack that England do. He has either created the break or he's done the pass to start the break or offloaded somewhere. He's in the middle of it. But just on Freeman briefly, I think he's been so good this tournament. He's not he's done what he needed to do and he's had his moments. I think that is just a sign of a really good player what's to come in the future.
Matt Dawson, when it comes to Ben Earl, do you think he has completely rewritten the script of what a number eight can do because of his stature and how he goes about a game? Because the traditional number eight is normally the big lumbering guy at the back who's got that extra bit of muscle, that go forward. And I'm not saying that Ben Earl isn't strong in any way, shape or form, but he is a different player.
Yeah, I think I'm probably going to be on my own here, but I still want to see him at seven. if we could find a top draw eight, which we are struggling with, let's be honest, then I think all of a sudden with Chesham and Earl at six and seven, I mean you're talking proper world class back row here, and I think that it potentially then just opens up the game even more for Ben Earl to be influential, because in the first half, when it, you know, particularly in the first 20 minutes, 30 minutes, didn't see a lot of Ben Earl. He was doing a lot of hard graft, but it had to be because of the enormity of the two packs. And he's a game breaker. He's a line breaker. He makes things happen. But it would be great to get him in. I think it'd be great to get him in a game more, and because I think he's got the capabilities. I think he's fit enough. He's strong enough. Reads the game well. Yeah, I mean, I want to see more of Ben Earl, if that's possible.
And saying that, Ashu, Tom Curry, we still don't know quite how he's going to react and what kind of a play he's going to be when he comes back from being out most of this season with his injury and now his surgery. But if he does come back, we know what the levels that Tom Curry can play at. I mean, we're talking about real depth now to this England squad.
Yes, let's hope he does get back. I mean, a hip and being a seven is really not ideal, but let's hope the medical have worked their magic and he does get back to the form that he was in previously before his injury. It would be a deadly back row if we could get that going, fit them all in there somehow. But I just can't get over how his work rate, how he gets through so much work. He's in the line out, tipping passes on, he's making breaks, he's making running back, covering tackles, and then he's chasing box kicks and hitting this, like, what can he not do? And I can't believe it's taken us so long to get to this point with him. Like, he's been playing like that for Saracens for ages, and I know it's a different level here, but he could have been in here 2 years ago at least. And even with Steve, it was a slow process to get him in and starting, but since he's been there, he's not looked back. But he's just so important for us right now.
Well, we're going to wrap up the table in a few moments' time, and we're going to talk a little bit more about France and also about Steve Borthwick. But let's hear from the England captain first, Jamie George.
Oh, look, I'm devastated with that, really, to be honest, because we went out there and I thought it's played some of our best rugby so far, and people questioned whether we could back up a performance. I thought we did that. Probably discipline let us down a little bit coming away from home to France. We know how hostile it can be, but thought we put them under a huge amount of pressure, and on another day we get another result.
Can you let us know what was said at half time? It did see that all of a sudden things changed slightly.
I think it was mostly tactical. I think we needed to be, basically the way that we were giving the ball to France was lighting them up. They're so good off turnover attack, loose ball. They seem to come alive, and you see it, you hear it with the crowd. And we were turning the ball over too easily at the breakdown in our carry. What we found was any time we entered the 22, they looked under real pressure, and that continued throughout the second half. The way we came out of the second half showed a lot of character, and really proud of the team tonight. Like, I think no one really gave us too much of a chance coming here, and like I said, on another day we get a different result.
Already people are going to start looking ahead to that summer tour, Japan, New Zealand. What will it mean to you to keep leading this team?
I'd love it. Honestly, it's been the highlight of my career doing this. Special thing, we've got such special people, such special staff, such special players, a young group, a hungry group, and I'm so pleased to have played a small part in that. And whatever Steve decides, he decides, but I will look back on this. Obviously it's been a tough time off the field, but the group have rallied around me and looked after me, and No, that's a sign of a very, very special group.
So that was Jamie George speaking to me just after the final whistle. So just a reminder, this is how the Six Nations table finished. At the top, we already knew Ireland had won. They'd wrapped it up with that victory over Scotland. France finished on second with 15 points. England in third on 14. Scotland fourth with 12. Italy, what a campaign they've had. No talk about promotion and relegation in the Six Nations. This year, they finished fifth with 11. And then Wales at the bottom with their first wooden spoon in 21 years on 4 points. And of course, all that talk about Warren Gatland offering his resignation at the end of the match to the chief exec, Abby Tierney, it was turned down. Just staying with England before we move into a French discussion. Steve Borthwick did say at the end of the match here in Lyon, "I'm really disappointed for the players. They worked so hard, and for the supporters who were magnificent. I'm immensely proud. You can see how the shirt is getting lighter." Chris Ashton, what do you make of this Steve Borthwick England? Because any just talk we had at the World Cup about this wasn't his team, this was still Eddie Jones' team. This is definitely his team right now.
Yeah, he took to the World Cup with a different approach, which we have been over, about getting it, just the experienced boys in there in short term and getting through, finding a way through the tournament. But this tournament, I think, in the Six Nations, we've definitely seen a change there. We've changed. And it's exciting, the players that we've got now coming through. Just the age range of them. We've got Ollie Chesham, we got George Martin, Jack Van Portfleet to come back in there. We've got Manny Feyenoord-Mbosso, Alex Mitchell, Marcus Smith, Freeman. We are at Furbank. They're all around the same age, which has all of a sudden come from nowhere, really. But if you go from the World Cup where everyone's questioning what do we do, what have we got coming through, and now we're in a situation where actually we've got some good players coming through. It's taken a few weeks for us to get to the point where we go, oh, we can see it now. But these two past games is a lot to take real positive going forward.
And Matt Dawson, I mean, you lived through that last incredible golden age of English rugby, that 2003 side. How important was depth to that squad and people nipping at your heels the whole time to get into that team?
Yeah, there's no question that if you want to be successful in the competitions, in Six Nations, in World Cups, you have to have the squad. And yes, the coach will have an ideal 15, 18 players that play a vast majority of the games. But you know, you're going to see injuries. George Furbank in the first 5-6 minutes. Right, what you're going to do? Someone's got to step in and be just as good, if not better. And all the top sides that have won big tournaments have got that. And the current example is Ireland. You know, you could run through half a dozen players there in that Ireland squad that are, you know, have stepped up from the World Cup. Sorry, have stepped in since the World Cup and have delivered a championship. So, yeah, I think where England sit at the moment with their backup, they're not short of players. But now, rather than just getting the players into the Penny Hill Park environment, it's about playing them, it's about giving them the opportunities and making them accountable for the way that England play, and they'll enjoy that and relish that opportunity.
Marks out of 10 on the England scorecard then for the Six Nations. What are you going to give them, Chris Ashton? Don't look at Matt Dawson if you're
boosted up the past few weeks. Six and a half.
Oh my!
Yeah, that's
really
fair. That's fair.
Six and a half.
Are you higher or lower, Sarah?
I was toying between 7 and 8.
No, that's too high.
Well, I just think off the back of them getting Twickenham on their feet last week for actually turning round a match that previously they wouldn't have found a way out of. I just you could see the glimpses.
14, yeah.
7, 8, 14. Oh, put me back in my box. Right then. Okay, let's move on to France. I mean, they had Lyon absolutely bouncing. I mean, it's been wonderful to watch France on their travels this year. They didn't get the results they wanted until they got here to Lyon. Chris Ashton, you've played a lot of rugby in France. What did you like about this French side? Because, gosh, it's taken them a long time to turn up in this Six Nations.
Yeah, they were all over the place first three games. It was just like they'd gone back 3 years. And whether that was the shock of not having Antoine Dupont, we don't really know the effect that he has on the team in and around them day-to-day training and stuff. And the World Cup thrown into that too. But it both clearly had affected the team. And it took some weeks to get back together and find a way for them to best get through it and manage it. But the past two weekends, after the fallow week, they've definitely looked more like themselves than just the France that we have come to know the past few years. Just more comfortable ball in hand. Le Garec, the scrum half, has definitely added to that. Just how much the French still actually rely on a good scrum half that controls the game is still...
Well, I think it's a position that's lost its influence across the game.
Control-wise?
Well, I just think in probably over the last maybe 10 years, the way that the game has developed has meant that the scrum half is a facilitator to pass and kick.
Has always been the case in France? It stayed that way?
I think in France they look to their nine to be the general and to not only pass and kick accurately but to snipe the fringes and do something a little bit different and make the moment and create the moment. They've always had that, whereas other countries might have had individual players, whether it's a Rob Howley or Joost van der Westhuizen, and someone who's just going to spark it up. And
you can put yourself in there if you want, you know.
Well, you can't really do that, can you?
Okay, should we do it for you, Matt Dawson?
Humble brags. But the game, I think the game had shifted away and the coaches didn't really want to see that from scrum halves. I hope we're sort of going back the other way, because if you look at, Ben White for Scotland has got that ability. Certainly Alex Mitchell here. Yep. Jameson Gibson-Park has been sensational for Ireland in this campaign. And then you've got Le Garec as well. So, yeah, I'm hoping that it's the game is allowing those types of players to blossom a little bit more. But, I mean, you talk about the French side of it very quickly, though. They've got to sort their defence out, actually.
It just seems like it's an easy fix, really. Set-piece defence.
But that's a huge pressure, surely, on Sean Edwards, who has come under, for the first time probably since he's been at France, a bit of pressure. There's been a lot of articles about him in a way that there haven't been before. He was being hailed as the great hero during the World Cup until, obviously, the quarterfinal. But at the same time, a few people questioning now, is his time up in France? He hasn't felt like that in this position before.
But not what the way they've got to come on unstuck tonight is just simply a numbers game. They're either too wide, someone's not getting the right man. It's easily solved, but you won't be happy with the frequency that has happened tonight is the unusual part. And through stages in the tournament, they've just missed simple one-on-ones that you just don't associate with Sean Edwards. And that's probably the shocking part. But I don't think what we've seen tonight is not that difficult to fix. It's just a simple understanding from my experience of that kind of those setup plays. It's just one person has misunderstood where they need to be on that assignment, and it's a quick fix.
Well, gents, we are literally about to be thrown out by security. So,
can I ask you a question?
You can.
I reckon there's not many jobs that I could do, right? I reckon I could do that one in spraying the paint off the pitch.
Would you enjoy getting rid of the advertising on the pitch, do you think?
Well, I don't think it's about enjoying
the ironing.
It's not quite satisfying.
It's not about enjoyment, but it's a job I could do.
All I've got at the moment is memories of when you didn't turn up at a game because a whole paint tin fell over in your car.
Yeah, exactly. So driving a car with a tin of paint is something I can't do, and now I realise that. But that one, I reckon I can.
Well, look, we'll have a chat with a few people at a few rugby grounds back in England and see what
like
we can sort out for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Matt Dawson,
minimum wage,
you're
good. I mean. So minimum wage, please. Yeah. And a baguette. Mozzarella baguette.
There we go.
I'll do a lot for a mozzarella. I know you will.
Matt Dawson is just absolutely mugging you off big time. I don't blame him either. Right, we're getting thrown out of Lyon. We're going to say thank you so much for joining us here on The Daily. Tomorrow, don't forget, Chris Jones, Ugo Monier, Sam Warburton and John Barkley will be here to wrap up the whole of the Six Nations. It's all over in Lyon. It was a French day. They won against England 33 points to 31. Right, guys, let's go and find a beer. Bye.
See you later.
Au revoir.
Grab your VIP pass. we're delving into the secretive world of Formula One. Behind the scenes with two of the sport's biggest names, Mercedes and Williams.
This is not coal mining, this is Formula One motor racing.
As they build their new cars,
we want to be so much further ahead.
And face shocking headlines.
Here's Lewis Hamilton moving away from Mercedes.
I'm Joseph Fiennes, and from BBC Radio 5 Live, this is F1, back at base. Listen on BBC Sounds.